This is Apologetics Profile, a production of Watchman Fellowship, helping you confidently defend your faith in Christ. For more information on this and any of our other podcast episodes or resources, visit watchman.org today. Here's your host, staff apologist Daniel Ray.
On September 1st, 1939, Adolf Hitler and the German army invaded Poland. World War II had begun in Europe. On the 22nd of October of that same year, C.S. Lewis gave a sermon at St. Mary the Virgin Church in Oxford called Learning in Wartime, where he addressed the objection of continuing one's education while the threat of war and uncertainty loomed over Europe like a deathly shadow. Why continue to learn how to be good philosophers, scientists, scholars, critics, or historians in such a dark time? Lewis notes, quote, "At first sight, this seems to be an odd thing to do during a great war. What is the use of beginning a task which we have so little chance of finishing? Or even if we ourselves should happen not to be interrupted by death or military service, why should we, indeed how can we, continue to take an interest in these placid occupations when the lives of our friends and the liberties of Europe are in the balance? Is it not like fiddling while Rome burns?" End quote. An emphatic no is, of course, Lewis's rejoinder, as he further explains, quote, "The war creates no absolutely new situation. It simply aggravates the permanent human situation so that we can no longer ignore it. Human life has always been lived on the edge of a precipice. Human culture has always had to exist under the shadow of something infinitely more important than itself. If men had postponed the search for knowledge and beauty until they were secure, the search would never have begun. We are mistaken when we compare war with normal life. Life has never been normal. Even those periods which we think most tranquil, like the 19th century, turn out on closer inspection to be full of crises, alarms, difficulties, emergencies." End quote. Our planet has always been at war. Life has always been done on the precipice of eternity. But it is not a war of flesh and blood, but a war against the principalities and powers in the heavenly places that is as ancient as man himself. Peaceful circumstances can make us forget this one singular fact. At no time is the pursuit of good philosophy and sound thinking unimportant. In fact, it is in times of circumstantial crises that good philosophy and sound thinking should be pursued with greater fervency. As Lewis observes, quote, "To be ignorant and simple now, not to be able to meet the enemies on their own ground, would be to throw down our weapons and to betray our uneducated brethren who have, under God, no defense but us against the intellectual attacks of the heathen. Good philosophy must exist, if for no other reason, because bad philosophy needs to be answered." End quote. In the midst of his own tribulations, Job, the beleaguered and suffering servant of God, takes time out to reflect on the goodness of true wisdom. Quote, "Where can wisdom be found?" he asks in the 12th verse of the 28th chapter. "And where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its value, nor is it found in the land of the living." End quote. Is there no hope then? Is true wisdom permanently unobtainable? No, for, quote, "God understands its way, and he knows its place. And to man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding." End quote. The pursuit of good philosophy, the love of wisdom, is a never-ending call of the believer in circumstantial peace or in the throes of great tribulation. On this two-part episode of Apologetics Profile, I speak with Christian philosopher Dr. Tim McGrew, who gives us all the basic nuts and bolts of why everyone does philosophy, why we should all be cognizant of our own philosophical assumptions, and why everyone should strive to be good philosophers, pursuing wisdom and truth to the glory of God, no matter if the stars be falling from the sky or the mountains be thrown into the sea. Well, I am here speaking with Dr. Tim McGrew. And welcome, Tim. We are actually in New Orleans at New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary. And thank you for joining us. I know you come to Fort Worth. You've been at the Atheist and Christian Book Club.
Yeah, I have.
One of our favorite in-house guests that we've had over the years. And we're going to get you back, hopefully, this year.
There's a funny story behind that, actually, so we can go into that if you like.
Yes, it is really funny. So glad to have you. It's fun to be here. This has been a whirlwind. Defend 2020. It's like drinking from a fire hose.
Absolutely.
It is a coming together. It's so fascinating to see people so passionate about apologetics.
Yes, it is.
Philosophy. I mean, there's a lot of young kids that are here that are really engaged, enjoying it, very missionally minded, very passionate about their calling, and love the interdisciplinary approach to that. We're going to talk a little bit today about your special area of interest, which is apologetics, of course. And philosophy of science, and how this relates to the apologetic discourse that we have today. And it seems like we are in a golden age of apologetics. Would you agree with that?
I think in many ways that's true, although I cast a fond eye back on some earlier periods of history as well and say, yeah, there have been several golden ages, but this is one of them without doubt.
Yeah, so what's fascinating to me, just talking to you just a second ago, was the idea that apologetics goes all the way back. I mean, literally, as we understand it as a discipline, a defense of the faith, literally goes all the way back to the beginnings of Christianity, is it?
Yes, it does. You can see this with Paul on Mars Hill. You can see the apologetic emphases in Luke's gospel and in the book of Acts. You can see, of course, some of the famous early church fathers, Justin Martyr, Aristides, Athenagoras, Tertullian, all wrote apologies, and these are important pieces for us to look at historically, and maybe more than just historically as well. And then there's a rich history right on through the Middle Ages and into the modern period with the deist controversy and, of course, the great debates of the 19th century. So This is a field that never grows stale. We have things to study in every era.
Yeah, it's amazing. And undergirding it all seems to be a necessity of having a good philosophy. And a lot of people that do apologetics don't realize that they're doing philosophy too. And it's like you got to have a good engine in the car. A lot of people that drive their car don't even know what kind of engine they have. They don't think about it. But you really get under the hood and get into the mechanics of really good philosophy. I've seen you on video a lot. I have this first time we've actually met in person. But go in a little bit about the nature of philosophy as it relates to apologetics. Kind of explain very layman's terms what philosophy is, why it's important to apologetics and Christianity even.
Sure. So philosophy is concerned with what we might call fundamental questions. And by that, I don't just mean that we use big words to talk about them.
Right.
But that these are questions where your answers make a huge difference to a bunch of other questions.
Yeah.
So these are the ones you'd better get right at the start, or you're really messed up.
Yeah.
And philosophy arises from an unusually obstinate attempt to arrive at real knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Not being satisfied with what passes for knowledge in everyday life, but instead being more careful, more precise, more tentative than we often are. And that's true whether you're doing philosophy for the purpose of pursuing apologetics or just for its own sake.
Mm-hmm.
But those are virtues that definitely have rewards when they're applied in the apologetic enterprise. So we ask deep questions about what there is, about how we know, about what is right and wrong. And the answers that we give to those questions have consequences, and we try to pursue those consequences carefully, rigorously, responsibly, so that if we're committed to certain positions, we are also willing to own the consequences of those positions.
Right.
Conversely, if you find that a position that you've adopted has consequences you absolutely cannot abide, then you need to go back and figure out what went wrong.
Right. Because it begins with the mind. I mean, as scripture says, you know, we are transformed by the renewing of our mind, but a lot of that process, the thinking process, the mechanics of thinking is philosophy, a love of wisdom, you know.
Yeah. And as Paul says, a willingness to test everything,
right,
and
right.
hold on tightly to what is good.
Hold fast to what is good, right? So I'd like to get into an area that fascinates me because I love astronomy and cosmology, the philosophy of science.
Sure.
You hear, and you've engaged with a lot of atheists and skeptics. You see a lot of the popular literature today where it seems like science, number one, is a dominant cultural authority for us today. If you're not a Christian or if you're not a theist, your cultural authority becomes sort of science. But do you first address the idea that science is a philosophy, and then the kinds of philosophy that you see going on in science, and some general examples about this? Because I think we tend to be intimidated by science. We tend to be intimidated if we don't know how to crunch numbers or do the math. But there are some basic things that we can know about the philosophy of science. And so just briefly, some underlying assumptions about the philosophy of science today.
So I want to say at the outset, science is done by scientists.
Right.
And they're not all on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because to listen to some of them, you would get the impression that virtually everybody agrees with them. Whenever somebody says that, either they're talking about things super uncontroversial, like the sky is sometimes blue, or they are philosophers with a philosophy to sell you, even if they don't realize it.
Right.
So, yeah, there are things that are so obvious no reasonable person should deny them. And then there are things that are so obvious to those who have adopted a certain philosophical point of view that they may find it inconceivable. And I mean that in the Princess Bride sense.
Inconceivable.
That anyone could not share them and still be intelligent, well-informed, and have goodwill.
Right.
So one of the driving assumptions behind a common approach to these things is, and I would call that scientism, and not just science per se,
right,
is the idea that all serious questions that matter can be answered by the methods of natural science.
And if they haven't been, they will be.
That's right. And so you're supposed to write a blank check to future science if present science hasn't quite nailed it down yet, and then just wait with your hands folded quietly. And what you're signing when you sign that check is that future science will deliver you an answer that is couched purely in natural terms.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are a lot of things for which we do want natural explanations. We want to look at how some parts of nature interact with one another to produce natural effects. And there's a broad background of all that everyone, Christians, agnostics, atheists, Buddhists, Jews, Muslims, should all agree on.
Yeah.
That's fine. But the idea that every event that happens in the natural world has nothing but natural causes is not something that science underwrites.
Yeah.
That's something that is given to us by a certain philosophical assumption imported into science.
Mm.
Naturalism sometimes wears the livery of science and presumes to speak in her name.
Yeah.
But that is a presumption. Mm. And we should separate real science and the undoubted conclusions of science and the technological advances that have been made on the basis of some advances in science from philosophical assumptions smuggled in as premises and then kicked back out as if they were conclusions.
Right. You go to Barnes & Noble or you get a book on Amazon or whatever, and you get a science book, you know, cosmology or astronomy or whatever these, but there is a lot of philosophy that undergirds, because there's theoretical physics and theoretical cosmology, and it's not all empirical observational science.
No, in fact, the subtitle of a talk that I'm going to give tomorrow has some words like observation, interpretation, and inference. And we, I think, tend to forget the latter two categories and assimilate it all to observation. It's just what we're observing. Mm. So how could we be biased? Right. We're just saying what we see.
We're just looking at the hard data.
But in fact, time and time again, when you peer beneath the surface here, there's a dazzling shine off the surface, and then you peer beneath that, and the depths are kind of ghostly, and you find philosophical assumptions swimming past you in the darkness, and you realize, oh my, this is not quite so straightforward as I was led to believe.
Right.
And sometimes it takes the form not of asserting only naturalistic explanations will do, but merely of omitting any alternatives as even relevant to the discussion.
Right.
Right. Imagine a beauty contest in which all of the participants are rather homely. Mm-hmm. Well, you got to make the best of a bad lot, right? You choose what you can. When I say this, I am, of course, thinking of the beauty contest of men,
right,
who tend to be much more homely than the fair sex. But if you're omitting the better-looking specimens, then, of course, you're left with what you're left with.
Right.
And I think at times, like Cinderella, the best theories get left at home without a prom dress, not invited to the ball.
Right.
And then we should not be surprised if no one is dancing with them. Of course, they're not there. They're not available.
Right.
And so we're making do with what else we have. Part of the task, I think, of a Christian mind, whether one views oneself as an apologist or a scientist or just an educated layman, is to recognize those times when assumptions like that are precluding discussion of viable alternatives. We can have the discussions. We can have the discussions with people who disagree with us. That's fine. Mm. I'm not advocating closing ourselves up in our enclaves and talking only to ourselves about our own preferred theories. Get out there and engage in the marketplace of ideas.
Absolutely.
Go for it. Right. Absolutely do that.
Yeah.
But I know that in my own home field of philosophy, in the philosophy of mind, for example, there are things that cry out for non-naturalistic explanations. Mm-hmm. And literally some of the most brilliant people you would ever want to meet simply can't see it because they've been trained not to see it.
Wow.
And in the natural sciences, exactly the same thing happens. Mm. You'll get someone who doesn't have ill will, but simply can't see that certain things are viable options. Or if they're brought up, they're brought up for a few seconds and then they're nervously dismissed. And we go back to discussing the things that most of his colleagues will allow him to get away with.
Right, right.
And these issues are too important for us to lock ourselves into a limited set of options. If there are other options that really deserve consideration, we need to do the hard work of showing that they deserve consideration.
Absolutely.
That's on us.
Yeah.
I'm not asking that anyone should give these theories any more credence than can be produced by showing their theoretical virtues,
exactly,
their merits.
Yeah.
That's fine. Do it on the merits. But we have to get them into the discussion at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that sometimes takes courage and a willingness to be a little bit insistent with people who just can't see it. At least these should be out here for discussion. You can disagree, but let's have a talk.
Put it on there. Dialogue.
Right.
It's interesting too, because a lot of this for the lay apologists or people just getting into apologetics or just, you know, engaging these topics for the first time, there's an intimidation factor where, you know, let's talk about, for example, the idea of whether or not the universe is designed, which is an ongoing favorite apologetic topic of a lot of people on the pro and the con side. But when you have a particle physicist or an astrophysicist who is an agnostic or an atheist, proclaim the universe is not designed,
right,
it's very intimidating.
Or a prominent zoologist.
Right. If you're in the field of biology,
the
zebras aren't designed. We can explain. So, but what we're talking about here is the philosophy. There is a philosophy in the assumptions of how you go about discerning design in nature. And it's a philosophical, at the heart, it's a philosophical problem.
Or whether you could detect it.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of unfortunate split. I'll call it by a name that it bears in the history of philosophy, and this is Averroism, which says, well, I can say certain things as a scientist or as a philosopher, and then I'll say certain other things as a Christian.
Mm.
The mild form of this has us just limiting what we are allowed to say as scientists and then saying, but as a Christian, I believe more. The worse form of it, I think, involves our saying one thing as a scientist and then saying something that is actually incompatible with it as a Christian, and then just pretending that there's not a problem.
As Monty Python says, is now for something completely different.
You know,
the complete switch, the compartmentalization of two competing ideas.
Right, and I think that is deeply unhealthy because in the end, we want to be unified intellects. We want to have unified minds. And so we shouldn't be saying, well, I'll say this as a scientist or as a biblical scholar, but I'll say this other thing as a Christian.
Mm.
I understand what moves people to do it. They've bought into a certain restrictive set of assumptions about what kinds of intellectual moves are allowed, what kinds of intellectual propositions can be contemplated.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the assumptions that prevail in their disciplines.
Yeah.
And then they want to have conversations with other professionals in their disciplines. Who would not?
Mm-hmm.
So the way that they reconcile the tension between the restrictiveness of those criteria and the things that they want to believe or that their non-specialist peers believe, they're expected to believe, is to say, well, I'll say this much as a scientist, and I'll say this other extra stuff as a Christian, or I'll say this much as a historian, this is a Christian, this is a New Testament scholar, this is a Christian. I think that that is a very troubling phenomenon. And there are good people who say it. And I don't mean to say that the people who do this are themselves vicious people
not at all, in any way.
But I think one of the things we can be wary of and aware of, and something we can help to combat even as laymen, you don't have to be a specialist to do this, is that kind of compartmentalization that leads us to say, I'm going to make certain claims as a Christian, but I don't want to have to back them up with evidence.
Yeah.
Instead, I would say, have a more expanded sense of what's admissible. And let's talk about things that maybe other people don't think you should be allowed to bring evidence to bear on.
Right. And I've taught at the middle and high school level at Christian schools for many years. And one of the trends I've noticed, kind of an oversimplification, but it exactly addresses what you're talking about. The way in which we do Christian education sometimes is, here's the quadratic formula. Oh, by the way, here's a Bible verse you could tack onto it if you want to. Well, how do I make them go together? You're just putting the quadratic equation over here and you're just giving me a proverb. How do I literally, like you said, we want to have a unified mind.
Right, integrated.
Integrated. Yeah. But we're teaching, I've seen it, I've done it, it's been in the curriculum, where here's the history of Abraham Lincoln and here's a Bible verse that it's some kind of moral truth that, you know, but where's the integrated Christian worldview literally woven into the history of Abraham Lincoln or the quadratic formula or mathematics or the Greeks or philosophy? And we're not getting that interdisciplinary gist into the mental machinery. We're not unifying things.
I think sometimes it arises from the fact that we're trying too hard in certain ways that we think we ought to be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Look, if you're teaching the quadratic formula, teach it, then show them how to prove it from the method of completing the square, then ask what happens if we're doing higher dimensional cases, and hey, how would we graph all of this, and what would and do all that, and then say simply, there's a long history of saying that God is a geometer, that mm-hmm. God is logical and mathematical, and this is beautiful. And what we're studying is something which, when you truly understand it, is beautiful. Rejoice, accept that, and stop quoting me a verse from Proverbs every time I do it. That's not the point.
Well, this concludes part one of my conversation with Dr. Tim McGrew on the importance of having a good philosophy. Whether it's in the classroom or in everyday conversation, in any circumstance. On part two, Dr. McGrew helps us break down some common philosophical objections to the Christian faith and what effective means we can implement in our daily conversations with our non-Christian friends and family. You do not have to be a professional philosopher to do good philosophy. Stay tuned for part two coming up next week.
This episode of Apologetics Profile has been a production of Watchman Fellowship Incorporated, Arlington, Texas. For more information on this and any of our other podcast episodes or resources, visit watchman.org today.